I said before, what I want to do tonight is split up this class. The first part about the Shoah and the second part about Israel. And the reason being is because, as everyone here knows, those two incredible events, one awful and one wonderful, took place in a very short period of time, literally within 3 years of literally out of the ashes of Auschwitz was born the state of Israel. And I'm going to get to Israel soon, but actually in this week's Parsha, our Torah reading is called Acharei Mot, and it deals with a tragic incident recorded earlier in the Torah, which is the death of Aaron. Aaron was Moses' brother, and he has two sons, brought what the Torah calls as a strange fire, an unauthorized offering. And they were stricken down. And one of the big lessons which you can learn from this episode is not only from a study of the episode itself, like why were they dealt with so harshly, what was so bad about what they did. Some say it's because they entered the sanctuary intoxicated, they were drunk. Others say because they had never been commanded, you don't just bring your own offerings, it's got to be part of a system. But if you recall what the Torah says immediately following the death of Aaron's two sons, their names were Nadav and Avihu, it says that Aaron was silent. Vayidom Aaron. Now, sometimes silence is amazing, and sometimes it's not amazing. This episode, when Aaron remained silent, he was rewarded. Because when you can somehow deal with a tragedy in life and not ask questions and just sort of take it and still believe God has a plan, so that's considered on a pretty high spiritual level, and the rabbis teach that Aaron was rewarded for his silent acceptance of this very harsh and difficult decree, the loss of his own two sons. But sometimes silence could be the worst thing in the world, and where silence as a response to tragedy is not a virtue but a crime, and I would put the Holocaust in that category. And that's what I just wanted to spend a few minutes with you, because I think the world, hopefully, will not forget the 6 million, but we may not remember the hundreds of millions who watched and remained silent. And that's just as important to think about. The dozens of governments who had the opportunity to intervene but would not sacrifice military, political, even economic support to save innocent Jewish lives. The terrible quota system, if you're familiar, in this country, that allowed only a handful of Jews into the United States, which turned two boatloads of Jewish people back to Europe, where they ultimately perished. Is anyone, I don't know if you're familiar with that? The name, anybody know the names of the boats? The St. Louis, very famous, and one was less well-known, was called the Struma. And they both were not allowed in. Anybody know the numbers? I did a lot of research when I was in graduate school on this, so I'm kind of up on all the details. But there was the quota system in this country from Germany in the same year as Kristallnacht, which is when most Holocaust scholars believe the Holocaust in earnest began, was 21,000. There were over 200,000 visa applications from Germany. I assume most of them were for Jews trying to get out. And it's a dark moment in American Jewish history. We always like to think that America's always been great to everyone and all the time. Overall, America has been amazing, and I still think America is still amazing. But those years, for many years, there was a lot of isolationism and xenophobia, fear of the other, and it affected foreign policy and it affected immigration. And as a result, Jews weren't allowed to come in, and a lot perished because of that. What was going on in Israel at the time? Jews who tried to get into Israel, who was running Israel then? The British was the mandate. The infamous white paper mandate. They wouldn't let Jews in either. So you had a situation where there was nowhere to go. And there were letters. I did a whole report when I was in graduate school where we were supposed to analyze the diplomatic correspondence of a ambassador abroad and his secretary of state. You can get the letters. They released them about 25 years later for security reasons. And any good university library will have the letters. So I analyzed the letters between Cordell Hull. He was Roosevelt's Secretary of State. He was the president. Cordell Hull was the Secretary of State during the Second World War. Ambassador George Wilson, who I think was an unsung hero. He was stationed in Germany. He was representing the United States. And he very assiduously reported what was going on to the Jews and how difficult things were for them. And I counted 23 letters by Wilson in the very short period between April 1938 until Kristallnacht, November 1938. That's just a little more than a year. 23 letters is a lot. It was before email or, you know, they wrote letters in those days. And as I said, these letters were written detailing the implementation of the Nuremberg racial laws to the Jewish citizens of Germany. And Cordell Hull wrote like two or three letters back. And the only thing he really addressed was how to deal with American Jews that happened to be situated in Germany at the time. And these letters are very important because they tell us what was known by the State Department of this country. And it's quite troubling. I'm not going to bore you with the details. If anybody wants to see my paper, I still don't even have it digitized, but I could, I wrote it. I was in Columbia at the time. I went to Columbia Graduate School and I worked on this paper there. And it's like a 50-page paper analyzing this diplomatic correspondence. It's a little boring, but if you want to see it, I think it's actually quite interesting. What's really interesting is this. I'll show you guys. This is the New York Times Magazine from 1997. That's why it's a little beaten up. It's old. Okay. You see what it says in the cover? My dear cousin Julius. So Julius was an American Jew who had a cousin from Germany whose name was Max Scholl. And they only recently discovered this wartime correspondence between these two Jews. One living in America, Julius Hess, and his cousin Max Scholl in Germany. And this really brings it to life. I could really photocopy the letters for you. And basically, Max Scholl is desperately trying to find a haven for himself and his family in the United States. He's trying to get out of Germany and come to America. And he sends all of these letters to his American cousin, Julian Hess. And Julius is quite sympathetic, but he has to overcome all these major hurdles. I talked to you about the quota system. So he tried bringing him in outside the quota system. Julius got him a teaching position as a chemistry professor in Charleston, Charleston University. But they denied his application for a visa.
Wow.
Why? Because he didn't have the 2 years teaching experience as a professor. Despite the fact that he had a PhD in chemistry, he taught as an assistant professor at a high school in Munich. He taught chemistry and chemical technology in Switzerland for 8 months, and for 20 years had been the leader in laboratories in a chemical factory where he had many assistants. And they still didn't let him in. So they tried to go to England. But to get to England cost a lot of money. It's like £600-700. It's a lot of money in those days. Max had a very successful business, but by this time the Nazis had forced all the Jews to give up their businesses, frozen all their assets, And so he asked his American cousin for 300 of the 600 pounds, for half the money. Now, Julius didn't have that kind of money, so he started trying to take up a collection. It's all in here. And they were kind of reluctant to help. They didn't feel such an affinity for their cousin. In a letter dated on August 13, 1939, the letter's in here, Max in his broken English wrote, "I cannot understand our cousins. When things were opposite, I know we would do all in our powers to help in such great need. There are four human lives. He's married with two kids. Of near relations which are in such great danger, and they cannot feel with us. We are almost disappearing." Oh, this is what's on the cover. This is what I'm quoting right now. We are almost despairing. The long waiting has taken away our powers. I myself will and cannot believe that we are condemned to perish in that country. We are innocents to our bad fate, and we trust on our God and on you and all good men that they will help us. That's from Max. And while this was going on, finally, they found out that on September 3rd, Britain declared war on Germany, and it was impossible to get into England. So they tried going to Chile, but they would still need a lot of money. So he started asking Julius for the money to go to Chile. $400 each family person. So that's $1,600. It's a lot of money in the 30s. So finally, Julius collected the money from his reluctant cousins. And in January 1940, Julius gets a letter that the family still had not left Germany because Chile closed its borders in the meantime. So they were advised new immigration plans to Brazil or Paraguay. Somehow they made it out of Germany. They got out to Yugoslavia. And in the postcard, Max tells Julius how happy they are, but they didn't want to stay in Yugoslavia because that was eventually going to fall to the Germans. So they were still trying to get out to America. "I beg you, please do not let my children perish. I know this is..." Max's wife wrote a letter. And she said, "I beg you, please don't let my children perish. I know that if my dear husband were in America, he would have already returned a portion of the money you've loaned us." And that same month, Yugoslavia fell to the Nazis. And for the next 4 years, the United States was at war with Germany. No more letters. The next letter that came to Julius Hess did not come till June 1, 1945, a month after the Germans surrendered. The letter was written by Max's daughter, because Max was no longer alive. 2 years earlier, as she describes in the letter, her father, Max Scholl, was sent to Auschwitz. And the reason I share this story is because the number 6 million is just too difficult to wrap our heads around. You know?
Is she the only survivor?
Of the family, yeah. Yeah. I think it's important to tell the story. Because the one thing that you have to remember, especially now with what's going on campus and in Columbia right here, is that it's not just the bad guys, it's the rest of the world's reaction. How does the rest of the world react when awful things happen? I'm not even going to go there right now with what's happening. You know? It's one thing, there are always going to be bad, evil people in the world. But and this is why, this is a good transition to my discussion with you about Israel. I usually do this in a whole class. Okay, I skipped a whole bunch. And then I usually devote a whole class to Israel, we just don't have the time. But this is incredibly important to remember that you can't really rely on other people. We like to think we can. And I just spent the week in a hotel in Passover with lots of Jewish people. And one of the other rabbis there was was a rabbi who works for AIPAC. And his whole life is devoted to strengthening the Israel-American relationship. And he's doing great work. And I think we should all support AIPAC. But I don't think we can put all of our eggs in any other nation's basket. If you're a student of history, of world history, certainly of Jewish history, you will know by now that the Jewish people can never rely only on other people, other countries. You just can't. We have to be self-sufficient because look what happened. And then I would say, oh, times have changed, but look what's happening today. Things have progressed so much on one hand, but things are just exactly the same. I'm not here to depress you. I'm here to alert you that not to be naive. And that's why Israel is one of the greatest miracles of modernity, not only because the creation of the state of Israel was just like unbelievable. You know, it represents the Jewish people's opportunity to defend themselves. And as awful as October 7th was, can you imagine something like that, a pogrom like that going on in Europe? What was the recourse? What was the response? What could Jews do? Complain to the authorities, who sometimes were part of those pogroms? You know, sometimes you'd find a sympathetic ear. And there were, by the way, please do not, I don't want to fluff over some very good Christians and others. The church was not great as an institution during the war. I wouldn't say they were complicit, but they certainly did not oppose Nazism. But there were some good priests and nuns and some good Christians who hid Jews. I'm sure here people know or have heard stories of Jews that were hidden at their own life's peril. You know, if Nazis found somebody hiding a Jew. And the King of Denmark came out with a big star, big yellow star. I don't know if you guys know that. There's an amazing thing. I just saw it last year of how the about 2,000 Jews from Denmark were smuggled across some river and were able to get them out of the country when the Nazis came, and they saved everybody. There were definitely people like that, but they were really a minority in a world that really remains silent. And so it's not just like a luxury to have Israel. A lot of people kind of think, yeah, we have Israel, we have New York, we have Australia. You can live anywhere as a Jew. That's just what we, thankfully, the generation that you and I happen to be, you know, raised in. But that could flip on a dime, as we've begun to see. So the state of Israel is just beyond miraculous, beyond miraculous. And I want to share a couple of stories with you about the establishment of the state of Israel. Any questions or comments, please? This is not supposed to be just a straightforward lecture.
When you say that everyone stays quiet, you mean the society in general or just us as individuals?
Yeah. We, you know, one person can make a huge difference in the world. And an organization like AIPAC can do a tremendous amount of good. I don't know if you saw that. They just got the $14 billion bill passed for aid for Israel. $14 billion. Israel usually gets about $3 or $4 billion from the United States every year. $14 billion. A lot of that is just to continue to afford the Iron Dome. Because every time they shoot one of those rockets in the air, it's $50,000. Did you know that? $50,000. And they can't ever shoot just one. It always has to be two. For the technology to work. That's $100,000 every time they push the button. There's also $1 billion in there for this new technology. You know the technology of the laser?
Iron beam.
Yeah, iron beam. It's like Star Wars. Which will be unbelievable because it won't be as costly. But they still have to, get it up and working. Anybody know how Israel actually started? Politically, technically, yes.
It was like a movement from Zionism to buy the goods land, usually from, I feel like, American or English people, and it would be like the worst swamp land ever because the donation was, and people
right.
would move there literally to trudge the land, these trenches to, like, be swamped.
Yeah, when did that start? When did Jews in modernity start going back to Israel? Now, there were always Jews living in Israel. We were there since the days of, since Moses brought the Jewish people in after, you know, we just celebrated Passover, the Jews got out of Egypt. We eventually got to Israel. And then Solomon built the temple, which stood for over 400 years. The Babylonians destroyed it, kicked us out, but we came back. And then we were there for another 400 years after the temple was rebuilt. The Romans destroyed that temple. And people stayed even after the Romans kicked us out. There were Jews that stayed, always Jews there. But we were, hey y'all, we were a minority for quite a while. We were a minority for quite a while until when? Anybody know? When did Jews in modernity start coming back to Israel?
1880s.
Thank you for all your help.
Shut up. Thank you guys.
Yeah, in the 1880s, very good. Who was part of this movement?
Herzl.
A man by the name of Theodor Herzl. And Herzl was a fascinating individual. He was originally an assimilationist. Do you know what an assimilationist is?
He wanted everyone to speak German, I think. Right. Original.
He wanted everyone to just blend in so much that they would stop being Jewish, and then there would be no more anti-Semitism. It was his theory. Okay, he wasn't a particularly religious guy, but he was a proud Jew. Anybody know what convinced him that that's not going to work either?
The
Dreyfus trial. Okay, Alfred Dreyfus was a Jew in the French army who was accused of spying on France for the Germans, and Herzl was a reporter stationed in France. He was from Austria, and he was working for an Austrian paper. And writing, and he was there when the throngs and the mobs, death to the Jews, death to the Jews, when they convicted Dreyfus like on nothing. It was a closed trial. The whole thing was kind of, not a fair trial. And he was just like, it doesn't matter if we assimilate; they're going to come after us anyway. I mean, Hitler didn't care if you were an Orthodox Jew or Reformed Jew or an unaffiliated Jew. If you had Jewish blood, he came after you. So Herzl understood that the only way for Jews to really stay Jewish alive was for us to have our own country. So they had the first Zionist Congress and the second Zionist Congress, and Jews started coming back. Now, what was the real impetus to come to Israel? Let's be honest. Pogroms in Russia and in Eastern Europe. It was very difficult. Jews were poverty-stricken. They were being chased after. And same reason that a lot of our Bubbies and Zadies came to America in the late 1800s, early 1900s. I think the numbers between like 1900 and 1920 of Jews that came to America was like crazy. My Zadie, my father's father, he came in 1920 like a lot of Jews did, just to get the heck out of, he was from Bialystok, Poland. And you either went to Israel or you came to America, basically. And the ones that went to Israel, they were a lot of the chalutzim. Chalutzim are like pioneers. They didn't want to just escape, but they wanted to build up Israel. They were Zionists. So Zionism was already, modern day Zionism was already a thing by the time the Second World War, came into being. There were already a few hundred thousand Jews living in Israel, not too many. I'm sorry, I don't have the number, like even an approximate number. A few hundred thousand, though, were living there at the time.
How many?
Yeah, in Israel, in Palestine.
600,000
in 48. Yeah, about 600,000, which is an interesting number. Same number of Jews who stood at Sana, but it's a different story. So they came, and... So how did Israel actually get set up, established as a political entity? This is very important for everyone to know, given what's going on today. Did Israel just, come in and take over and just attack, the Arabs that were living there already? Anybody know? How did Israel become a state?
Like through the UN?
United Nations. United Nations, what happened? Well, the British were running it. And they were Arabs living there, they were Jews living there, and they weren't getting along. And the British were also keeping Jews from coming in. Why were Jews trying to get in? Because of what we said in the first part of our class tonight. They were trying to escape Nazi-occupied Europe. And a lot of Jews were thrown into jail and put into detention centers, before the war, even. We had a very interesting relationship with England. Because on one hand, England was a tremendous ally. England was, you know, took on the Nazis. On the other hand, they were making life miserable for the Jews, or making it impossible for Jews to get into Israel, to British, you know, mandated, you know, controlled Palestine. So finally, the British couldn't take it anymore, and they decided they were going to leave. And the United Nations decided what they were going to do is split Israel into two. It wasn't called Israel, it was called Palestine. They would give a part that I guess would be called Palestine to the Arabs. And then they would give the other part to the Jews. That was called, what is that called, guys? It was called partition. Were we happy about that or sad about that?
Thrilled.
We were thrilled. If you go home tonight, you can put on the YouTube. And you can see, like, Jews dancing in the streets. They have videos of Jews dancing in the street when the United Nations voted in favor of partition. It was amazing. Arabs, not so happy. It's actually a day, it's called Nakba in the Arab world, which is like the day of, like, infamy. The way the Arab world reacted, essentially, was to attack. The next day, five Arab armies attacked Israel. And that became what's called Milchemet HaShechur, the War of Independence. So when anyone talks to you about a two-state solution, why doesn't Israel give a state to the Palestinians? Your answer is very simple. Israel has offered, and the world has offered, a state to the Palestinians many times. The first time was in 1947, November 29th, 1947, when the partition plan was passed. They didn't want it. They didn't want it then, they don't want it now. They were also given the Gaza Strip to create something as well. And even if Israel maintained security over the high seas and the air, because they call it an open prison, an open-air prison, it's nonsense. That's for security reasons. There's nothing that was stopping the Palestinians. The 2 million Palestinians living in the Gaza Strip since Israel vacated the Strip in 2006. There was nothing stopping them from creating their own government, their own infrastructure, their own hospitals. All of that was entirely possible. They took all the money, billions and billions of international aid, and they built terror tunnels. And where do you think all these rockets came from? They're expensive. So, So this is very important, and that's why knowing what happened and how Israel actually began in the very, very beginning is important. You had a question?
How is, what Israel doing any different than the U.S.-Mexico border with, all security we have there?
The difference is that if the United States was threatened with the same issue, they would do a lot more. Most countries would do a lot more. Israel, is the only country that I can think of in modern history that is not allowed to defend herself. That is, their legitimacy is called into question for simply defending themselves. It's unfortunate that innocents have to die in war, especially if the bad guys are hiding behind the innocents, and hospitals and mosques are being turned into launching pads for terrorism and rockets. So what are you supposed to do? Just let them keep shooting? So Israel does the best that she can. They drop leaflets, they make phone calls, and they tell people to get out of there. We're about to come in and bomb. I assure you, no other, even Western country does that. The United States didn't do that in Afghanistan after 9/11. I'm not saying that carpet bombed everything. They tried to minimize civilian casualties. The numbers are being exaggerated, and a lot of the 30,000 of Palestinians being killed include all the terrorists, at least 11,000 amongst them. And those are the people we want dead, you know. So anyway, getting back into the original history, this is really what's being celebrated the week after Yom HaShoah. But it's incredibly important that we know the details and the facts as to how Israel came into existence. Initially, it was not born in sin, like much of the world believes, that it should never have been. There was a native there was a population of Arabs that were living there. They didn't really have a past Palestinian sense of nationalism at that time. They were just Arabs, you know, living there. And it is unfortunate for those Arabs that got caught up in the middle of the War of Independence, and they had to flee from their homes. And some of them were told by the Mufti of Jerusalem, who was a terrible anti-Semite who spent the Second World War in Germany with Hitler. He sided with the Nazis. This was the most important Arab leader in Jerusalem, the Mufti of Jerusalem. He was a great Muslim leader. And he told his people to vacate their homes, to leave, and so that, and then they'll come back after they destroy all the Jews, because they were so confident. They had like five Arab armies, and we had like a straggly band of Holocaust survivors. It was fewer than 55,000 soldiers faced the combined militias of five Arab armies of Egypt, Syria, Jordan, Iraq. Who am I missing?
Libya.
What's that?
Libya.
Was Libya involved in Mohammed Ashukhur? I'm not sure. Lebanon. You know, so this was... Israel surprised the world by surviving. And not only surviving, but by thriving. And I want to read you one speech that a woman, you all heard of Golda Meir. She was one of Israel's great prime ministers. Did anybody see the documentary? I was very disappointed. Did anybody see Golda? You saw it? What did you think?
She smokes a lot.
I know she smoked, but like that's all they showed her was smoking. Yeah. And I know she looked like an old woman, but they made her look so haggard. They made her look so old and so like, oh.
Well, I mean, Helen Mirren still better than Golda.
I mean, I'm not saying she wasn't a good actress. I just, I don't know. She was amazing. Listen to the speech that she gave. She was sent, this is in 1949, I believe. When was this? This is such a cool speech. Ben Gurion was going to come to the United States. Anybody going to know Ben Gurion, who was the founding prime minister of the State of Israel, and he was going to come and raise money. They needed to raise a lot of money. And there were a lot of Jews in America already at the time. About the same number of Jews that are in the United States today, which, by the way, should upset you because we should be triple the size. But that's for another speech. Golda Meir goes instead of Ben-Gurion because Ben-Gurion was needed to run the country. He was a great wartime prime minister. And Golda Meir said, what you want to do in America, I think I can do. But you stay here and run the country. She came to the United States, and she came on a fundraising mission. And she was supposed to speak in Chicago, and says, pausing only to buy a coat with which to face the American winter, she set out for Chicago. This, by the way, is from a book called O Jerusalem, which is a great book written about the founding of the State of Israel. Golda Meir heard the Toastmaster announce her name. At sight of her simple, austere figure moving to the speaker stand, someone in the crowd murmured, "She looks like the woman of the Bible." Then, without a text, the messenger from Jerusalem began to speak. Wait, hold on a second. Ah. She, "You must believe me," she said, "when I tell you I have not come to the United States solely to prevent 700,000 Jews from being wiped off the face of the earth. During these last years, the Jewish people have lost 6 million, and it would be presumptuous indeed of us to remind the Jews of the world that 700,000 Jews are in danger. That is not the question. If, however, these 700,000 Jews survive..." So, I mean, you're pretty close. "Then the Jews of the world will survive with them, and their freedom will be forever assured. But if they did not," she said, "there is little doubt that for centuries there will be no Jewish people. There will be no Jewish nation, and all of our hopes will be smashed." In a few months, she told the audience, "A Jewish state will exist in Palestine. We shall fight for its birth. That is natural. We shall pay for it with our blood. That is normal. The best among us will fall. That is certain. But what is equally certain is that our morale will not waver no matter how numerous our invaders may be. And then she said that I came to America to raise $25 to $30 million. That's a lot of money in 1947. My friends, we live in a very brief present. When I tell you we need this money immediately, it does not mean next month or in 2 months. It means right now. Can you imagine getting up? She was the only woman in the room. It's 1940, you know? And it was all the federations. You guys know UJA Federation, you know? It is not to you, she concluded, to decide whether we shall continue our struggle or not. We shall fight. The Jewish community of Palestine will never hang out the white flag before the Mufti of Jerusalem. But you can decide one thing, whether the victory will be ours or the Mufti's. Anybody know what happened? Good speech, not good speech. Come on, that's a kick. That's a kick butt speech. That's like, right? So a hush fell on the audience, and for an instant, Golda thought she failed. Then the entire assembly of men, oh, and women, rose in a deafening wave of applause. Somebody said that there were no women there. While its echo still rang through the dining room, the first volunteers scrambled to the platform with their pledges. Before coffee was served, Golda had been promised over $1 million. They were made available immediately in cash, a fact without precedent. Men began to telephone their bankers and secure personal loans against their own names for the sums they estimated they'll be able to raise later in their communities. You hear that?
Wow.
By the time that incredible afternoon was over, Golda was able to telegraph Ben-Gurion her conviction that she would be able to raise the 25 steffens, the $25 million, in the code that they had chosen. They called it steffens after Rabbi Stephen Wise. It was actually a very prominent Reform rabbi in the United States who was a great Zionist and very helpful to the cause. Astounded by her Chicago triumph, the American Zionist leadership urged her to set off. And then she went from 25 million and ran around like I just, well, I'm not going to mention what I just did because it's to be. She ran around raising money and says that the woman who had arrived in the United States one bitter January night with $10 in her pocketbook would leave with 50 million. 10 times the son Eliezer Kaplan had mentioned, twice the figure set by David Ben-Gurion, 3 times the entire oil revenues of Saudi Arabia for that year. She raised 3 times the amount of oil revenues for Saudi Arabia, $50 million in 1947. Waiting for her airplane at Lydia Airport, that's before they started calling it Ben-Gurion, was David Ben-Gurion, the man who wanted to go in her place. No one appreciated better than he the magnitude of her accomplishment in the United States or its importance to the Zionist cause. The day when history is written, he solemnly told her, it will be recorded that it was thanks to a Jewish woman that the Jewish state was born. I love sharing this. I just think it's so powerful. So she raised a lot of this money from American Jews. Does anybody know who was the biggest? Where did they get their arms from with this money? That's what they needed money for.
Czechs. Czechs, yeah.
Czechoslovakia, very good. And then France.
Yeah.
The United States did not start supplying arms to Israel until after the Six-Day War. And I'll tell you something else about the United States and Israel and the Six-Day War. They made it very clear from the CIA to the Mossad that if Israel shot the first bullet in the Six-Day War, which the only thing they had going for them, because they had a terrible, terrible mobilization of multiple armies on multiple fronts, the Syrians in the north, the Egyptians in the south, 465,000 soldiers were mobilized on all of Israel's borders. And Israel was on high alert for weeks already, and they wanted to attack preemptively. Element of surprise. But the United States made it very clear, we cannot back you if you shoot the first bullet. It has to be a war of defense. It was a war of defense. Just because you don't shoot the first bullet doesn't mean it's not a war of defense. There's 465,000 with hundreds of tanks and warplanes, you know, poised on your border, ready to attack. What did Israel do? Israel preemptively struck, and thank God she did. Because that preemptive strike enabled Israel, this is 67, this is 19 years later, enabled Israel to have the strategic air defenses in place. Because they basically wiped out their enemy's air forces within 3 hours of the war. Had they waited to attack, it could have been a very different outcome. But you could say to yourself, should we wait for the United States to help us or not? Now, I'm not saying you never. And this is coming up again today. Like, everybody was expecting Israel to be a very forceful response to when Iran attacked a couple of Saturday nights ago. And they did strike back. But it wasn't a crazy response. So some people say, because they want to finish God, I don't really know the truth. And you should come this Shabbat, because I want you to ask this question of someone who actually knows the answer to this question. Colonel, I'm
printing.
Is it Caracas? How do you? He was in the hotel with me over Passover.
Yeah.
And this guy was the IDF spokesperson for the IDF for the first 3-4 months of the war.
Oh, that guy.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Cool. Yeah. Caracas.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm an Israeli guy. He was in the hotel with us. I got to know him a little, and I asked him, what are you doing next Shabbos? Because I happened to be in New York. He lives in Kfar Saba in Israel. But he said he'd come. I chummed up with him. And he's an amazing, amazing guy. You should ask him this question, because I think what people were saying is that Israel was getting closer and closer to finishing up Gaza. But we got to Rafah and the world went crazy. So the United States put a lot of pressure on Israel, leave Rafah alone. Israel saying, well, give us the hostages. We won't go into Rafah. Then Iran attacks. Why didn't we go crazy back? So some people were conjecturing that it must be that they're making a deal. The United States is saying, chill out on Iran, because that's really going to escalate, and you can do what you need to do in Rafah then. But this is what's going on. And I'm not saying it's foolish for Israel not to continue to work with the United States. Of course she needs to do that. America just gave $14 billion to Israel. But Israel also sometimes needs to go at this alone. Because as much as sometimes, you know, we all have friends, but our agendas are a little different, even our best friends. They have a little of a different agenda. So it doesn't always work. And so that's what's, you know, but the theme that I wanted to really share, and I'll end with this, and if anybody has any questions, the theme I wanted to share from our discussion about the Shoah into Israel is that there was one fundamental change, which is not unprecedented in Jewish history, but unprecedented in over 2,000 years, and that's Jewish autonomy, that we get to decide our own fate. And when people say, what do you need Israel for? It's such a, I'm like, whatever, we're fine in other countries. People are saying this now, get out of Israel, go back to where you came from. Do you remember why we went to Israel? Now, we don't go to Israel simply because we're running away from another country. We go to Israel because God told Abraham, Lech Lecha, go. It's the land of our forefathers. It's our spiritual heritage. It's our birthright. That's why we believe in Israel. But we will never be our own masters in someone else's country, even in the greatest country in the world, even in the United States of America. We don't have our own army. We don't have our own government. We can vote. And we can try to get in good candidates and try to, you know, I don't know what we can do with bad candidates. You know, we can certainly not support them or try to dissuade others from. But it's still not our country. It's not our government. So that's a very, very important thing to keep in mind. That's what changed with the creation of the State of Israel. That's what flipped when we went from destruction with the Holocaust to redemption. It's not just that we have a country. Okay, great. Now we'll be able to live in Boca Raton, New York City, and Tel Aviv. Now, it's much more than that. It's A, coming back to Israel, the land of our forefathers, and B, it's being able to determine your own fate. And that's an incredibly, incredibly important thing. That's worth sacrificing for. You know, we're living in very, very historic times, especially now, post October 7th. I'm just babbling at this point. Any questions, comments, please? What do you have to say? It's a small group. Feel free. Yo, what do you think?
I have a lot of questions. One of them was that point you just made about, like, Harry saying we're not really, we don't have our own country, we don't have our own, we can vote, we don't have our own military. So I thought about if you were to tie that to any other nationality. But, like, if the Chinese didn't have a country and you were to say, hey, you know what, we live in America, but we don't have our own economy, we don't have our own military, like, we need our right for self-determination. Like, how that plays into this... the argument for Zionism, but
yeah.
The thing about it is, it's just been very hard. Is if you spend more time in center right wing Jewish circles, you often hear the story that Israel is a victim, that the world does not like us, the criticism in the UN is unfair, which it is, you could say. And then, but if that's the case, how is it that there's so much dislike for Israel now? Cross college campuses and states, and is it, are we doing anything wrong, or are these people clearly wrong or doing the right? That's where it gets a little bit.
I mean, I'm not one of, Israel's a democracy. And Israelis tell their own government what they're doing wrong. They tell them every day. And of course, Israel does things wrong, but I don't think the criticism, there's fair criticism and there's unfair criticism. Okay, expecting Israel to be able to do the impossible, to be attacked and not respond, is what I consider unfair criticism and simply anti-Semitism. Because what's the difference between trying to kill someone or saying to someone else, you don't have the right to defend yourself? They're really not any different. They're really both calling for the destruction of that same person or entity. But even if Israel was, like, what else could have Israel have done? I'm just, like, wondering, like, how many more overtures of peace should Israel have made to the Palestinian people that they can now be accused of not really wanting the Palestinians to have their own self-determination? Most Jews want them to have their own state.
Well, I think the bigger issue is that the modern left is under sway of a certain type of progressive view, which views Israel as the biggest colonizer. If Anne Frank had lived, they would have called her a colonizer. They would have called her a colonizer.
Right. So that has to do with
But that's why they think Israel is the ultimate evil, because it's like an international group of colonizers coming together.
Right. Wait, before you move on, why is it, and why do you think Israel is viewed in that way? Well, why is that? What has Israel done to deserve that characterization? It's simple. They're powerful. And anyone with power, particularly if you associate that power base with white, if you're white and you're powerful, then you're morally in the wrong, no matter what.
Yeah.
I heard this on Trevor Noah a few years ago, one of the last things. And Trevor Noah was saying, look, I don't want to get into all the details about the Palestinian-Israeli. It's too complicated. All I know is that when you have two brothers, and one is bigger than the other, and the other is smaller, if the bigger one beats up the smaller one, he's in the wrong. And then he starts saying, but what if the smaller one keeps throwing things at the bigger one and buys guns and does something? Is the older one ever justified defending himself? And according to what Trevor Noah was saying, no. The older one can never defend himself. And I looked at all of the responses of when he said that, it was like on some YouTube thing, and everybody agreed with him. And I was like, really? I was the younger one. My brother always beat on me. You know, I was the younger brother. And I fought back. But would everything be justified? And my brother would be never justified because he was bigger?
But what you said about the binary of the stronger one is colonizer, the weaker one is indigenous, brown, black, which is why... it has nothing to do with that, because they would also say... You know, Anne Frank had white privilege in that thing. So again, but ultimately, that is why they deny October 7th, because the oppressed cannot be bad. So when the bad details came out, that is why the need to deny happened, because you can't have the oppressed do the bad thing.
You can't
have to deny it.
Someone who is oppressed is by definition has the moral high ground.
Yes. So if they, so it doesn't compute for them to commit this. So they have to, in their mind. I mean, I know. I mean, a lot of people think like Israelis killed all of Israelis. Like, you know, they think a lot of.
I heard. I don't want to mention.
This generation of Palestinians, or particularly like this young generation, is so uniquely passionate and will do anything to defend what they really truly believe. And also, I don't know if this makes me like really dark, but I always think that it could have been so much worse. And like, meaning like with what happened at Columbia University, like, thank God the police responded the way they did.
Yeah.
Like, not, they wouldn't necessarily, we couldn't have been so lucky. We wouldn't have always been so lucky.
I agree. It could have been a lot worse. It could have been a lot worse.
Like, they responded really well, I think. There was so much police.
The police responded well. The university was a disaster.
It's a private institution.
Right. I just, I had this, I was on a panel in the hotel where I was for Passover, and they were talking about what's going on a college campus, and one woman came over to me afterwards. She has two kids in Yale. She has a son who's a senior and a daughter who's a sophomore in Yale. And I said, I know at some point we have to ask ourselves whether we can justify, you know, contributing dollars, significant dollars to institutions that are showing themselves as anti-Semitic. You know, and the counter to that is, well, if we pull all of our Jews and our money from these institutions, then it'll just get worse. But I don't know. I'm a little jaded on it because I was in Columbia in the early 90s and it was bad. So we've had, I don't know, 25, 30 years to fix it. And it just keeps getting worse. So I'm not really sure what the point of sticking around is, you know, other than getting the you know, the fancy degree. I don't know. It's there was a whole group of you women from Barnard who just announced that they're leaving Columbia.
Really?
Yeah.
I saw people. I drove by yesterday and there were people with bins, so it must have been something like that outside Barnard.
They're leaving. I don't blame them.
Redining?
What's that?
They're redining?
No. They're students.
They're transferring.
Should I burn my Columbia degree?
I don't know. I saw someone had this great. Did you see that? It was a great like Instagram reel of some woman who took her Columbia degree and ripped it up.
Oh yeah.
I assume she had a copy. That's what I was thinking. But
it's a printout. You can always retrieve. Like you can always ask.
Yeah, but it's. That was a very, very well said. You know, any other comments, questions before we finish up? Yeah.
I have a couple of my own theories, but they sound very, very Looney Tunes. But
give us the least Looney Tune one.
I heard this online. Every conspiracy theory out there is anti-Semitic. Name any conspiracy theory. Like 9/11 was an inside job.
Right.
Yeah.
Who was that inside person? Oh, was it like a group of secret old people with like a cryptic language? Name another one, like the Kennedy assassination was like an inside job. Oh, it was run by the mob, run by someone else. And who are those like people with like the secret
Illuminati
institution?
Right. Right.
So that's always out there. And then TikTok is run by the Chinese.
Mm-hmm.
Very, very anti-Semitic. I've been on TikTok since like 2019. It's addictive, and I've always gotten anti-Semitic comments on there, no matter what. And you can't delete them. You can't do anything on that app. Like, it's
There's no question that what's turned the minds of our youth is a combination of Qatar's heavy investment in academia in this country. And number two, TikTok. That marriage has been toxic. And if we don't regulate TikTok in this country, and we don't somehow figure out how to ban... I don't get why universities are permitted to take this kind of money from terrorist regimes. It's such a scam. It's such a scam. And it's literally corrupting an entire generation.
Look at it. Like, what happened with the hall, the campus, is no different than January 6th. I mean, they just watch these videos real. I mean,
yeah.
They just believe these conspiracies. No, that is that.
So I think now that we're aware of the issues, we can work on. Somebody called me today, wanted to know if I'd like to get organize a prayer service, a Vatican prayer service, a sunrise prayer service in front of Columbia next Wednesday, like they did in Washington. Would you guys get up at like 5 in the morning and come with me to Columbia and daven chakras in the morning? What's that?
We're doing it in the microphone.
Well, would it be on campus?
So that's the thing. I need some help getting a permit.
Ask Moshe Davis.
Yeah? Ooh, let's call Moshe tomorrow. That's a good idea.
Protest afterwards?
I don't know. I think a nice peaceful davening. I think a nice peaceful davening. It's just with lots of Israeli flags. Like, we're not going anywhere.
Well, people were contrasting what's been going on
and
in
US
Columbia with UCLA.
Yoel is here to represent the West Coast.
It got really wild. I was like, I don't want to be recognized.
We're
going to
close up because we got our fellowship class. What is our topic next week?
So next week we have a Yom Shoah event on Monday.
Monday night.
Yeah, we're having a survivor from the Holocaust come share her story. Everyone else will be interviewing her. And then the following Monday, we have a Yom HaTzibut event. We're going to have like a shuk experience, so that would be cool.
Right, so there's no Wednesday night class at 7 next week. Come Monday instead.
Okay.
And then we'll resume the following Wednesday.
It's Monday again. It's 2 Mondays.
Right.
Again. And then we have a Shabbat dinner next Friday night on May 10th, if anyone would like to join.
Awesome. Great. Have a wonderful night.
You too.
It's good to see you, Ilya. Are you going to have a penny?
Yeah.
Awesome.
Thank you.
I'm going to be going tomorrow. Call back if you want to come. I don't know if it's going to be that place.
Yeah.
You want to get
it?
Oh, he's teaching it now?
Yeah.
Oh, thank you for coming. It's a pleasure. Are you around? By the way, are you around the Shabbat?
That's a cool napkin.
You're in Brooklyn. Right, let me know when you come to the city. I'd love to have you over for a meal.
You guys are so hungry looking.
To my home.
Israel, American pins.
Yeah, if anything changes and you're here this weekend, let me know.
Take one or two.
No, Saturday lunch.